Moses led the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And as he did, so they came to Kadesh Barnea, and he sent 12 spies into the land. And there came back a report from those 12 spies. The majority, 10 of them, said, "We can't go into that land. We can't conquer that land, for there are giants in that land. There are people that are insurmountable. There are people that are bigger than we are. We cannot control these people. There is no way." And so for 40 years, those people wandered in the desert. 400 years later, we find another person standing before a giant. This morning, as we talk about that familiar story of David and Goliath, I want us to think about the Goliaths that are in our lives. What are those looming, seemingly insurmountable things that overshadow everything in your life? I found one pastor's description in Leadership Journal in the current issue. He wrote this: "I trudged to the mailbox after a draining counseling session. I hoped to find a letter from the search committee of a big church or a large care package with giant homemade cookies and cheery notes made out to me with an attached letter. Dear pastor, consider this $1,000 a small token of our love for you." No such luck. The mailbox contained 2 medical bills from my wife's surgery, a phone bill, the quarterly car insurance premium. Seeing the medical bills made my heart throb. The church treasurer recently had bounced a check to the insurance company. We weren't sure if my wife's surgery was covered. The pile felt heavy as I dumped it on the kitchen counter. Bad health, big bills, rebellious children, unrelenting and unforgiving boss, sinful habits that take over, dreams and expectations that are dashed and continually blocked. What are the giants that you face? Found this story of a young mother who said, "It was the worst day of my life. The washing machine broke down. The telephone kept ringing. My head ached. The mail carrier brought a bill I had no money to pay. Almost to the breaking point, I lifted my 1-year-old to his high chair, leaned my head against the tray, and began to cry. And without a word, my son took his pacifier out of his mouth and stuck it in mine." How do we deal with those difficulties that seem to be so insurmountable? David gives us some help. Now, in the midst of talking about a very familiar story, I don't want us to miss some of the principles that I believe God would have for us of how to defeat, how to gain victory over those giants that live in your world. I want you to turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 17. Now, before we begin reading this familiar story, we need to place this particular scene in the whole context of the play. Now, you remember as we began our series last week talking about chapter 16 that we find this young man, David, anointed to be the next king of Israel. This David went back after being anointed by the prophet Samuel to herding the sheep. Whatever he was doing, he went back and did it. In chapter 16, verse 14, we read that the Spirit of the Lord left Saul. And then there's that very confusing portion of that verse that says, "And an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him." Now, there's all kinds of interpretations. We're going to get a little bit into that more depth next week. But just suffice it to say that I believe that as God is the sovereign Lord of all of the universe, including all of the evil angelic realm, I believe that the Lord sent specifically, sovereignly designed a specific demon to torment Saul in order that he be humbled before the Lord. Now, with that said, we notice that Saul's men noticed that there was a change in their boss. Look at verse 15. Saul's attendants said to him, "See, an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord command his servants here to search for someone who can play the harp. He will play when the evil spirit from God comes upon you, and you will feel better." So Saul said, okay. They searched throughout the land, and they found this one young man. Happened to be the guy who was anointed just a few verses earlier. David. So David comes into the presence of King Saul, and Saul knows him as his guitar playing lad. Look at verse 21. David came to Saul and entered into his service. Saul liked him very much. David became one of his armor bearers. Then Saul sent word to Jesse saying, "Allow David to remain in my service. I'm pleased with him. He's a good boy. Boy, he plays that guitar good. I'd like to have him around." Saul says, okay, so he enters into the service of Saul part-time. He's still shepherding sheep. I'm not going to ever say that again this morning. He's still doing that and part-time helping out Saul, playing his guitar. We think of the harp as something that's, you know, kind of large and you plucky. Well, actually, this is more like a guitar. He was playing that. He was carrying all of this armor around for Saul. This is what he was doing for his employment. Now, we find the Israelites again up against the Philistines, chapter 17, verse 1. The Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Soko in Judea. They pitched their tents at Ephes-Damon between Soko and Aziah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with a valley in between them. Okay, here, picture this. The valley of Elah is 15 miles west of Bethlehem. And here on the north were some hills. This is where the Israelites were. And on the south were some other hills. This is where the Philistines were. And there was a valley in between. This is the valley of Elah. Now, in the middle of the valley was a deep ravine where water flowed when it rained. Okay, this is the setting. And we find these Philistines ready to do battle with the Israelites. Now, if you remember, as we talked about last week, we briefly mentioned where the Philistines had gathered together to fight the Israelites a little earlier. Chapter 13, verse 5, describes a little bit of the Philistine army. It says that there were 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand as on the seashore. And it's this kind of army that has been amassed again on the south hills of the valley of Elah, ready to fight the Israelites. Now we learn from this story that it takes 40 days for there actually to be any kind of engagement. It's probably because those chariots couldn't pass over that deep ravine. So here they were, kind of waiting things out, looking at the situation, wondering how it was going to all develop. Okay, now we find that though they couldn't use their chariots, they were going to use their ace. His name was Goliath. Look at verse 4. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Now get the picture of this guy. Goliath was over 9 feet tall. In the Hebrew, it says he was 6 cubits and 1 span. Here's a cubit, 18 inches. Here's a span, 9 inches. You add it up, and this gentleman is 9 feet, 9 inches tall. I'm afraid that Goliath here, this must be Goliath's younger brother, because he's not quite 9'9". He was taller than that. Do you want to take a picture? Isn't that incredible? Here was this man, and the armor that he carried weighed 125 pounds. Just the head of his spear weighed almost as much as a bowling ball. And he threw it. This is not a little man. Not only that, but he had a person who was a personal shield bearer. Now, this wasn't a little shield that went around like this. This was to protect his body. You need a sheet of plywood, folks. So here's this guy that has a sheet of plywood, 4 feet by 8 feet, and he's carrying this thing. It's covered with leather in order to protect it from fiery darts. The armor bearer alone was somebody to be scared of, right? So here's this Goliath that comes out to face the Israelites. Look at what he says, verse 8. He shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? I'm sure he had a deep voice. Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. If I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us. This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight together." Now, what he was doing was something that was very common in that day. We might call it representative warfare. In order to save all of the armies and from everybody becoming extinct, one representative would fight another representative of the other army, and whoever won for the entire army, for the entire nation. And so Goliath said, "Come on, bring out your best guy. I'm going to go hand to hand with him. Whoever wins, you're our servant." All right. Now that's looking at it from the Philistines' point of view. Here are these guys camped on the South Hills. And here's this Goliath guy that comes out. And we find out in verse 16 that he torments them, he taunts them, he spits in their face, he yells at them, he intimidates their God for 40 days and 40 nights. My word. Now look at verse 11 and then look at verse 24. This is how the Israelites were responding, how they reacted to this giant in their land. Verse 11, "On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified." Look at verse 24. "When the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear." Folks, I want you to put your finger on those feelings that you have when that giant in your life comes looming across your path again. Whether that be finances or health or a people person problem. Whatever that is, do you grasp the kind of terror, the kind of fear, the kind of inability to do anything that these men also felt? Do you sense that? Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the shepherd ranch, Jesse, he's an old man. All of his boys are up at the battle lines. He hasn't heard anything. He's getting antsy. And so he puts his care package together. And he gets Mrs. Jesse together, and they put this nice thing together, and they said, "David, you're the only one left here at home. You're the only one that's not up there. Take this up to the boys. Encourage them. Tell them that we love them. And give them all this good stuff, would you?" David goes up. Look at what happens. Verse 20, early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd. Loaded up, set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their battle lines, facing each other. David left his things with a keeper of the supplies, ran to the battle lines and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance. And David heard it. Okay, now, the scene has been set. The protagonist has now seen the whites of the antagonist. The giant. The one who is opposed to God. Indeed, God's enemy. David has seen him. Now, as we go through the rest of the story, I want to highlight three things that David did that give us principles, give us guidelines for victory as you face different giants in your life. The first is this. Be cognizant of God's enemy. That's the first principle. Be cognizant of God's enemy. Back to the story. David sees Goliath. He's greeted his brothers. Verse 25. Now the Israelites had been saying, obviously to David, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel. David's shaking his head. He's still blown over by this giant, surprised at what he's saying. Look at verse 26. David asked the men standing near him, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Tell me again. And who is this uncircumcised Philistine anyway that he should defy the armies of the living God? Who is this guy? Verse 27. They repeat to him what they had been saying and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. Now, the principle is applied here beginning at verse 28. Notice it with me. David is standing there with the other soldiers and his brothers. And you remember who Eliab was? His oldest brother. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you lead those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. David, you really aren't interested in how well we're doing. You just want to see a show. You're interested in entertainment tonight, aren't you? You really don't care about what's going on here. Now, why don't you get back to those two sheep you take care of? Ooh. Do you sense the bitterness? Do you sense the jealousy? Do you sense the anger? Why? Chapter 16, you remember? Samuel said, Jesse, I want to have a sacrifice with your boys. And he was going to anoint the next king of Israel. And here Eliab walks forward, the strong firstborn. And Samuel said, no, he's not the one. And so Samuel anoints this little punk kid. You bet. Eliab's jealous. You've been in that kind of a situation, whether it's sibling kind of rivalry or rivalry within the body of Christ. You've been tempted to, because of jealousy, anger, all kinds of things, to poke jabs, start a little skirmish with somebody. Tell me you haven't, but I know you have. Notice what David does. Verse 29. Now what have I done? I can see my kids saying that. Said David, can't I even speak? Look at verse 30. This is it. He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. Do you see what David did? Eliab is jabbing him, saying, come on, fight me, buddy. I'll flatten you. And David says, no. And he walks away. Did you see what David did? He was tempted to get into a fight with his brother. Listen, my boys. He was tempted to get into a fight with his brother, but instead he turned away. Why? Because he had seen the real enemy. Folks, it hasn't been that long ago where this little instrument was foreboding in a conservative church. And yet, let's get angry. Evidently, it was a repeat segment. And they showed mostly men and how they were expressing their anger on the highway. They showed all kinds of vehicles with bullet holes strafed up and down the vehicle. People were killed because somebody cut them off or got in front of them or weren't as in a hurry as they thought they were. And so they started shooting, beating up all of these people that they thought were their enemy. People they didn't know. People whose priorities they had no idea. We get in the same kind of rift. We start fighting people within our family, within our fellowship, who aren't really the enemy. Folks, if we're looking to be victorious over the giants in our land, in our life, we need to realize, we need to be cognizant of the fact of who the real enemy really is. Take stock. Paul says that our real enemy is not flesh and blood, but the powers and principalities of evil in the heavenly places. Certainly they might have a human body. They might be... what's the word I need? Enfleshed. Incarnate. They might be evil incarnate, that particular individual. But our real enemy is not one another in the family of God. It's not one another in our own human families. We need to take stock of who is the real enemy. Okay, now once we get that set, we can move on. Second principle is this. Be confident in God's power. Be confident in God's power. Well, evidently David is talking amongst these other soldiers and his brothers. And he's saying, I can't believe this guy is saying these things of our people and of our God. I can't believe this guy is getting away with all this stuff. I feel like knocking this guy's head off. And Saul hears about it. Saul hears that his music boy is with the troops. And so Saul sends for David. And David goes into his presence. Look at verse 32. David said to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Saul replied, you're not able to go out amongst this Philistine and fight him. You're only a boy. He's been a fighting man from his youth. Paraphrase. Boy, you be a good music player. Man, you play that guitar like really good. But, brother, this is some ruthless, gun-slinging, head-knocking, feet-thumping, low-down. He ain't no good, man. He's going to knock your head off. David said to Saul, listen what he says. He's convincing Saul that he's the guy to do the job. Verse 34. Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, rescued the sheep from its mouth. And when it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and be with you. The Lord be with you. Now think of it. This is incredible. Here Saul has been sitting with his commanders, his generals, for 40 days and 40 nights. They've gone over the roster of all the soldiers they got in town every day for days and days, singing, well, can he do it? No, he can't do it. Can this guy do it? No, he can't do it. Finally, here's this David, this young boy, a teenager, that comes forward and says, I'll whip that guy. Well, on the one hand, Saul's saying, oh, we got somebody. Good, you do it. I don't want to do it. But on the other hand, you have to remember that if David loses, it's too painful. And yet, Saul says, okay. What was it? What was it that convinced Saul that David could do it? Why was he putting his fate and the fate of his entire army in this young boy's hands? It was because of what David said. He said, listen, Saul, I'm not just a mamby-pamby guy. I'm not a jellyfish, milquetoast, cowardly kind of kid. No, I've fought lions and tigers and bears, oh my, and I've whooped every one of those suckers. I've grabbed them by the hair. I've cut the living head off. Everything that David had done in the past, all of those situations where he had trusted God and God delivered him, that's what convinced Saul not only that he would let David go, but there was a possibility somehow that David could do it. Now, Saul didn't understand how he could do that. And so he did what he only knew how to do. He got out his armor. Look at verse 38. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and he tried walking around. Now imagine, here is a boy. He's a 38 regular. Dressing in somebody's 52 long. And he's dragging this sword around. Trying to walk. David goes, cow, you're out of your mind. I can't wear this stuff. And he takes it all off. And then he says, then Scripture says, verse 40, he took his staff in his hand and he chose 5 smooth stones from the stream. Okay, so here, verse 40 takes us from the top of this north side of the hill down into the valley, into that ravine where David picks up 5 smooth stones. Now, before we go further, the principle here is be confident in God's power. How, again, did he have confidence in God's power? How was it that David was able to stand before Saul and say, I can take this guy out? How did he do that? It was because of his victory over lions, over bears. A few years later, there were 3 men, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that we more affectionately know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who stood before another kind of giant. This giant's name was Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar says, you bow down and you worship me or you're in the fire. And these men said, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, We don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it. And He will rescue us from your hand, O King. But if He does not, we want you to know, O King, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. How was it that these three men grew to have such overwhelming confidence in God's power? Think of the giant in your life. How is it that you can come to the point of saying, God, this is a giant, it's a big one, but I believe your power is sufficient to conquer it? How do you say that? How did David say that? How did Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah say that? The same way we do. Simply by looking back at past experiences with God. That's it. We grow in our confidence in God's power by looking back at our past experiences with God. But you say, Rob, how do I gain past experiences with God? Right now I've got this big giant in my face. Today, you will have all kinds of things in your face. Some of them are going to be big giants that you may not be able to conquer today. But I'm confident that you're going to have smaller giants in your way even today. And so the trick is to trust God for those little things. Those little giants. Sure, they're a giant to you. Maybe not to somebody else. Maybe the anger that you feel in your heart about a particular situation, nobody else is bothered with. But for you, it's a giant. If you trust God to help you be victorious over that particular circumstance, you will be gaining ground. Because you will be trusting God in that particular situation. Maybe there's a difficult person in your life. Maybe there's nobody else that has problem with this person, only you. Maybe that's it. And maybe today, they throw something in your face. Golly, another giant. Maybe it's not a giant to somebody else, but it's a giant to you. If you're able to trust God to have victorious in your life, at that moment, you will have a trophy. A trophy to look back on and say, yeah, God did it. Yep, July 7th, 1996. God did it. I remember. That's what David did. He looked at his experience with the lion and with the bear. And those were the kind of experiences when he experienced God's power that he was able to say, yeah, this is a bigger giant, but I can do this one too in the power and might of the Lord. Well, how did David get the strength to conquer the lion and the bear? In the same way, he had a previous experience where he had trusted God and he experienced God's power and saw God victoriously working through his life. And how did he experience that? Well, he tried something else over here, something that was difficult, something that was demanding of him. And he trusted God in that particular circumstance, and God's power was sufficient to give him victory. And you see, it's a series of progressions. We will never have victory in the first-class giants in our world, in our life, until we have victory over the seventh-class giants in our life. It all starts right now. If you don't have anything to look back on, you have today. Trust me, you'll have giants even today. Do you remember from the story, I don't remember what verse it is, after David takes Goliath's head off, what does he put in his tent? What does he take home with him? Do you remember? Goliath's sword. Yeah, he put a trophy right there and he said, God did it. God's power did that. I am firmly convinced, folks, that we too frequently etch our failures in stone and our victories in sand. We don't remember the kind of things where God has brought us victory. And yet that's what God's calling us to do. To remember those things that He's done for us, because that's what gives us fuel to trust Him in bigger situations with bigger, more formidable giants. Third principle is this. Be concerned for God's honor. Be cognizant of God's enemy. Be confident in God's power. Thirdly, be concerned for God's honor. All right, we're joining the story back again. And we find David in the bottom part of that ravine with five stones in his hands. Now, Goliath has been standing there taunting the Israelites. He's been watching this young pup walk down the hillside, across the valley, down into the ravine. He probably didn't think much of it until he saw David looking at the whites of his eyes and holding his slingshot with a rock in it. And all of a sudden, Goliath goes ballistic. He can't believe that the Israelites would treat him like this. He wanted a real fight with a real man. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 41, meanwhile the Philistine with his spear bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. So as David's walking toward him, he's walking toward David. He looked David over. And he saw he was only a boy, ruddy, handsome. And he despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." Now I want you to notice David's response. He gives us insight into his heart. He gives us insight into what is motivating him to stand before this giant. Verse 45. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with a sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord, and He will give all of you into our hands." So why did David go into battle with Goliath? Verse 46. "In order that the whole world might know that God is alive and well on planet Earth." David wasn't looking to save his own neck. He wasn't even in the army. He was concerned about the honor of God. He wanted to protect God's name, character, and reputation. He was so concerned about that, that he was willing to put his life on the line. Oh, that we had more and more people like David, who are so concerned, so passionately concerned about the name and the character and the reputation of God, that will put our life and everything that we have and everything that we are on the line. Second reason why David took this step, verse 45, to show to all those gathered, all the world, especially the Israelites, that God doesn't save by a spear or a sword or a javelin or a chariot. No. God saves by His might and His power alone. We read in Psalm 33, "No king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. Despite all its great strength, it cannot save. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear Him, on those whose hope is in His unfailing love, to deliver them from death and keep them alive in famine. We will wait in the hope for the Lord. We will wait in hope for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. In Him our hearts rejoice, for we trust in His holy name." David was so consumed with God's honor, knowing that He is able to bring victory, that he stood before Goliath without any kind of protection, physically. Of course, just to finish the story out, Goliath was so incensed that he didn't have his head on his shoulders. All right. He was so concerned about this young boy that was coming after him that he didn't put his helmet on. Or at least he didn't put his little thing down to cover his forehead. He just whipped that stone and they practiced. David knew exactly what he was doing with that weapon. And it went right into his forehead and he died. He hit the ground. What a thud. Ay-yay-yay. David went over, cut his head off. And I love this. He went back into Jerusalem. You know, it's 15 miles to Bethlehem and then just a few then to Jerusalem. Dragging this guy's head. What a picture. What a trophy, huh? All because he knew God's power and was willing to trust Him. Folks, when we look at the giants in our life, sometimes we are tempted to run away. We cower in fear and we don't deal with them. We don't look at them. We don't address them. We don't trust God to work through them. And yet, God will bring us victory. He will bring us His success as we trust in Him. You don't have to be walking around cowering in fear because of whatever looms over your head. We don't have to live that way. There is a plain all, something like this. Very simple, very unornate, very used all that is on display as a trophy, if you were, in the French Academy of Science. It was that particular all that fell off of a dad's workbench and into his 9-year-old son's eye, causing him to become blind. Soon after that, he went blind in the other eye. And just due to an accident, this boy was faced with a giant. This was the cause. The giant was blindness. This boy started to learn how to read using big wooden carved blocks. It was cumbersome. It was slow. He was so frustrated. And so he conquered that giant by using the same awl that caused him to become blind to punch holes in paper. And Louis Braille learned how to read a different way because he didn't allow the giant to step on his head. He trusted. He was looking for God to bring him victory, even through, even because of, in spite of that giant. whatever giant may be in your life is not too big, not too insurmountable. If you've never trusted Him in overcoming that particular giant, look back. Look at those ways where God has given you victory. Carve that in stone. If you need to, erect a trophy case where you can put things on display, like swords from giants, to remind you of God's power. He's there to deliver you.